Straight Shooter with Stephen A.
I am writing to inform you that Representative Kevin Kiley has resigned as a member of the House Republican Conference. Signed sincerely, Lisa McClain, Chairwoman, House Republican Conference. The Honorable Tim Walberg, Dear Mr. Chairman, this letter is to advise you that Representative Kevin Kiley's election to the Committee on Education and Workforce has been automatically vacated pursuant to Clause 5B of Rule 10, effective today. Signed sincerely, Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House of Representatives. The Honorable Sam Graves, Dear Mr. Chairman, this letter is to advise you that Representative Kevin Kiley's election to the Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure has been automatically vacated pursuant to Clause 5B of Rule 10, effective today. Signed sincerely, Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House of Representatives. The Honorable Jim Jordan, Dear Mr. Chairman, this letter is to advise you that Representative Kevin Kiley's election to the Committee on the Judiciary has been automatically vacated pursuant to Clause 5B of Rule 10, effective today. Signed sincerely, Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House of Representatives.
There you have it. Hour number two, Straight Shooter with yours truly, Stephen A., right here with you over the airwaves of SiriusXM POTUS Radio. I've got another guest, and he represents California's 3rd Congressional District. He made headlines last week when he announced his switch from Republican to Independent. Please welcome to Straight Shooter with Stephen A., the one and only Congressman, Representative Kevin Kiley. How are you, sir? How are you, Representative? How's everything going?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. So let's get right to it. What was the breaking point that made you switch parties, sir?
Well, I think partisanship has just gotten out of control in this country. And I think that, in particular here in Washington, and maybe the thing that was really the breaking point was this redistricting war that's broken out across the country, where we have states throwing out their congressional maps in the middle of the decade to favor one party or the other, to make everything about partisanship in our politics. So I was against this in Texas. I was against it in California. I was against it in every state where it's happening. It's, of course, upended our map in California. And so my view is, look, if you're going to make everything about partisanship, elevate that above everything else in our politics, maybe the right antidote is to just take partisanship out of the equation. And, you know, that's actually how it's done in the vast majority of offices. You think about your school board member, your city councilor, your mayor, your DA, your sheriff. These are nonpartisan offices. They're not looking to serve a party agenda. They're just looking to solve problems. At least that's how it's supposed to happen. And I think we could use that approach in Congress a lot more.
Well, listen, you heard the clip when I was coming in introducing you, and you see that you've been removed from these three committees. And Griff, put it right up there for me so we can see it again. Education and the workforce, transportation and infrastructure, and the judiciary. These are places you were removed from following the House committee assignments. Your thoughts about those decisions that were made, removing you from all of that?
Well, so actually, this is the crazy thing, is there was no decision made. This is just automatically what happens under the House rules. It shows you how deeply embedded partisanship is, how deeply rooted it is in the very structure of the House of Representatives, is that these committee seats are the property of the parties. And if you disaffiliate from a party, it just happens automatically under the rules. You lose your committee assignments. So I think actually I have it's likely that I'll get those assignments back because the chairs of the committees like having me on them. But it's a pretty crazy thing when you have to be affiliated with one party or another, or else you lose your committees.
You feel the way that you feel, and I get that. Is it about politics overall in the nation's capital, or is it about specifically the GOP, which you were a part of?
It's about the hyper-partisanship that I've experienced here in my 3 years, which I think is really weakening us as a country. It seems to have reached peak levels over the last year or so. We saw the longest government shutdown in U.S. history. We've seen these healthcare subsidies expired at the end of last year because the parties couldn't come together. And then we have this redistricting war that I just referred to that, is unlike anything we've ever seen. And these things are mutually reinforcing. It's going to make our politics even more partisan. It's going to make, the House and Congress even more partisan.
Some people would say that what you described in terms of those three incidences that you brought up, healthcare, of course, obviously the shutdown, stuff like that, as painful as it may be, as detrimental as it may be to the American public at large, the bottom line is they wouldn't still describe it as hyper-partisanship. They describe it as politics as usual in the nation's capital. To you, what makes it hyper?
Well, I think your point is well taken that, you know, this is not something that has just suddenly happened. Everyone knows that things are broken in Washington, D.C. Congress has like a 15% approval rating. But I do think it's also true that things have just gotten worse and worse and worse. And we're seeing, you know, things like the longest government shutdown we've ever had in our entire country's history. We're seeing, you know, this phenomenon of gerrymandering, this plague of gerrymandering going across the country and saying we're going to, you know, make partisanship the sum and substance of our politics. And what I've observed, you know, and this is not a new phenomenon, but again, I think it's more intense now than it's ever been, is that the focus is always on how do we blame the other side for the problems we have as a country, as opposed to actually trying to come together and find common sense solutions to those problems.
Will you still be caucusing with the Republicans?
For the remainder of this term, yes, because, you know, that is the way the rules are set up right now, is that essentially to be a fully functioning member of the House, you have to caucus with one of the two parties. And since that's how I was elected at the beginning of this term, I think that makes sense.
That's totally fair. Totally understand that, sir. But respectfully, how does that, you know, what does independence look like in practice if you still have to caucus with the Republicans? I'm just asking because I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, in practice, it actually is a reflection of the way I've generally approached my job, is that, you know, regardless of my party label, I've always said I'm going to be an independent voice for my district. So, you know, and sometimes I voted with, you know, Republican leadership. Other times I've gone against what the rest of our party did on particular issues, because I've always said that I answer to my constituents as opposed to party leaders in Washington, D.C. So I think that, you know, this new designation is simply a reflection of that philosophy that I've had all along. And hopefully maybe it'll, you know, inspire some others to take the same approach.
Representative Kevin Colley right here with Stephen A. Straight Shooter with Stephen A. Leadership reportedly felt blindsided when you went public, if I remember what I read correctly. Was that a calculated strategic move on your part, or is the internal communication within the caucus fundamentally broken in your estimation?
I don't know that it was calculated. It was simply, it was just, you know, this was a matter between me and my constituents. And so I did, you know, inform folks in D.C. After I made that decision. But, you know, I made an independent decision as to how I thought I could continue to best represent my district and folks in my area. And but I, you know, I did tell the speaker and others about it afterwards.
Well, you're certainly not planning. It doesn't appear like you're planning on leaving office. And to be quite honest with you, I'm glad that you're not. Let me state that for obvious reasons. But you've left open the possibility of caucusing with the Democrats next term. What specifically will Republicans have to do or fail to do to lose your support?
Well, what I've said is that I think that if you're going to be independent, then you shouldn't prejudge these things, right? And so I've said I'm going to caucus with Republicans for the remainder of this term because that's how I was elected. When it comes to the new term, you know, who I'm going to caucus with, what the speaker, who's I'm going to vote for speaker, I think I'll look at it at the time and say, all right, what is going to be best for the folks that I represent? And, you know, I think a lot's going to happen between now and when in the next election. You know, I think that I'll have by that point almost a year of having been an independent in the House. And so I'll make that decision at the time.
You're, I mean, when you think about you and being elected, I mean, your old district was split apart, obviously, and now you're running in a Democrat leaning seat. You know, for the purposes of cynics out there, to address them because of some of the things that they'll say, just being straight with the voters, is this a principled position you're taking, or is it something that is tantamount to political survival in your estimation? How do you answer critics or cynics who would say such a thing?
Yeah, well, I'd say, first of all, you have every right to be cynical because there is so much to be cynical about in politics. That is sort of a safe default when you kind of look at something that's happening in Washington, D.C. But my direct answer to it is that if I really was concerned first and foremost about political survival, there was a much easier path I could have taken because my district, as it now exists, was chopped into six different pieces. One of those six was turned into an overwhelmingly Republican district, what they call a safe district. People run for those seats. They can remain there often for their whole lives if they want to. And I was well set up to win that seat, but I didn't run for it because I thought that would make things worse rather than better. I thought it would exploit the gerrymander rather than seek to overcome it. And I thought that, you know, I want to continue to represent the counties where I was born and raised that have always been my home. And I think they deserve a representative who answers to them rather than party leaders. So that's the reason I made my decision. And in terms of the principle of it, you know, While some people have opposed all this gerrymandering in one state or another, depending upon whether it helps or hurts their party, I've been against it everywhere. I was against it in Texas. I was against it in Indiana. I was against it in Virginia, in California, because I think it's just bad for democracy.
It's good to know. You recently voted with Democrats to cancel Trump's emergency tariffs on Canada, if I remember correctly. Was this an attempt to appeal to independent voters and Democratic voters?
Well, I've actually voted for this multiple times now, and it was more than just a vote on one particular set of tariffs. It was actually a vote, first and foremost, to reclaim the authority of the House of Representatives when it comes to trade policy and tariffs in particular, because the House had voted repeatedly to essentially make it so you couldn't challenge that, even though the House has that constitutional and statutory authority. And so I had been against that several times when this came up, and I was one of three members who ultimately did succeed, or on our side, on the Republican side at the time, who did succeed in reclaiming that authority for the House. So then we had a subsequent vote on the issue of the Canada tariffs. And in that case, I thought it was a pretty straightforward issue. The president had actually declared a state of emergency for fentanyl coming over the northern border. That was the predicate for imposing the emergency tariffs. Canada has actually cracked down on fentanyl. So that suggested to me that Congress should exercise its authority to terminate the emergency. But on the issue of the tariffs themselves, it absolutely is true that the Canada tariffs have had a huge impact, or at least a very significant impact, on the cost of living across many key sectors, the auto industry, energy, and a number of others. And, we need to be focused on lowering the cost of living in every way we can right now in this country.
Representative Kylie, I recently was reading an article. It talked about the GOP fleeing from Congress. 51 House members, 12 senators have opted not to run for re-election. 30 of them have been Republican. 6 of them are departing from the Senate. I'm wondering, when we talk about folks leaving, how concerned are you about the GOP in terms of their willingness to either capitulate to everything that the president wants, or deciding to leave and not serve the people of the United States of America? It seems to be two extremes, one or the other. How concerned are you about that?
Well, as far as the retirements go, people have different reasons. Some of that is people are just running for Senate or running for governor or what have you, running for different offices. I do think that there is growing frustration with the dysfunction that exists in Congress, which, again, isn't a new phenomenon, but seems to have gotten a lot worse. And is reflected in the 13 or 15% approval rating that folks have. Now, in terms of Congress exercising its constitutional authority, I think this is a really serious issue. And I think that, whoever the president might be, Congress ought to have as its sort of foremost institutional, responsibility to protect the prerogatives of the legislative branch, to protect the separation of powers and the checks and balances that our founders so wisely put into the Constitution. And you have seen this tendency where the majority in Congress is the same as the White House. There's been a tendency to cede authority to the executive branch. So that's not a new thing either. Over the course of decades, we've seen Congress sort of systematically divest itself of its own power, which is a really bad thing when the founders designed the House of Representatives to be the branch that is closest to the people, faces election every 2 years. To the extent that we're losing our power, then, our democracy is becoming less representative.
Forgive me for not knowing the answer to this question, but I'm asking you, what was your position when President Trump decided to attack Iran? And we heard that Marco Rubio had alerted the Gang of Eight, but it wasn't necessarily so that Congress as a body was addressed and approached before these actions were taken. What was your position about that at that particular moment in time?
Well, what I said was that Congress needs to be centrally involved going forward in defining our objectives and, in terms of how those objectives are pursued. I kind of get the need to have some discretion in advance of an attack like that when it comes to how broadly Congress is advised, because, we have a body of 435 people, and if the military objectives are relying on the element of surprise, that becomes difficult. This is why, for example, issues when it comes to the use of military force are different than, say, tariff policy. The president actually has inherent authority under the Constitution when it comes to, military engagements. But I was also quick to say in that same statement that that authority is not unlimited. And so that's why Congress needs to be involved going forward.
Do you believe that the president has been excessive in his use or abusive in the power that he has as the commander in chief of this country, considering some of the things that he's made, bombing Iran last June? Then again, obviously, what's transpired about 19 days or so ago and the kind of effect that the tariffs, a lot of people felt that they've taken issue with that. There's a lot of different things that's affected this country, positively or negatively, depending on who you ask. But as it pertains strictly to his power and the usage of it, do you believe that he's been on par with what the president of the United States should be allowed to do, or has he been abusive?
I do think there are examples where they've likely exceeded the limits of executive authority. But again, that's something that basically every president has done. Every president has tested the limits of executive authority. President Biden was struck down by the Supreme Court on a number of occasions. That's actually part of the design of our system, is that, our founders envisioned that the president or each branch would seek to push the limits of its own power. And so they created this dynamic equilibrium where the branches push back against one another. So on the tariffs, I thought, we've seen that happen sort of in practice, where now Congress and the Supreme Court have said that, we believe that the president has exceeded his authority under the relevant statutes to unilaterally impose tariffs. I look at the national security issues a little differently. For example, Venezuela or Iran, very different cases, by the way. You had an outstanding war.
Yes.
In the case of Venezuela. And in the case of Iran, we do have a longstanding policy in the United States that Iran absolutely cannot be allowed to get its hands on a nuclear weapon. So yeah, to the extent that the objectives there are being pursued as they were initially communicated, then there's an argument to be made that falls within the scope of the president's inherent authority. But obviously, there comes a certain line that you cross when congressional authorization is required.
Two-part question here. Any concerns, particularly considering what's transpiring in the Strait of Hormuz? Obviously, with 20% of our oil, which 20% of oil goes through worldwide, and obviously that's stagnant at this particular moment in time. Any concerns about that and how this situation could continue to proliferate with Iran? And also, what do you think is going to happen with the United States as it pertains to Cuba?
Well, the question of Cuba is a complicated one, and I don't know that I have a clear answer to you for you at right now. I think that U.S. interests there are similar to the interests that we had in play in Venezuela. You also have a regime that has not been overly favorable to U.S. interests. In the long term, of course, we'd love to see freedom and democracy for the people of Cuba. I will say that, we've have a number of foreign entanglements at this point in time. So I'm not sure that you're going to see anything particularly dramatic there, at least in the near future.
Okay.
But I will say, with respect to Iran, of course, the regime there, which has been very battered at this point, they're trying to do everything they can to expand the scope of the conflict, to bring other countries in, to make things as painful as possible for the U.S. Some of this was anticipated. Maybe some of it was not as anticipated as it might have been. But I'm extremely concerned about the issue with the Strait of Hormuz and the impact that has on gas prices in the United States. Although I will add that in California, our gas prices are really, really high, and that's not
Yes.
the main reason. We have $5.56 per gallon right now in California, nearly $2 higher than the national average. California is literally importing gasoline from the Bahamas because our refineries have fled the state and our regulations are impossible to comply with. So there's a lot we need to do to lower gas prices in California that's unrelated to anything happening in Iran right now.
Getting back to you specifically, you acknowledged recently you likely had a better chance of winning in the Republican, say, 5th Congressional District, currently represented by longtime Representative Mr. Tom McClintock, if I remember correctly. Why did you choose not to run in that district?
Well, because I didn't think it was at the end of the day the right thing to do. Number one is that my home communities where I have was born and raised, went to local public schools and represented throughout my time in elected office, they're mostly in this new sixth district. And so I wanted to be able to continue to represent my hometown. But secondly, I thought that to respond to this gerrymandering scheme by just going and seeking out the safest possible district, that would just make things worse. And I thought, well, maybe there's an opportunity here to find a different way forward, to set a different example, to try to, instead of making our politics even more partisan, to try to make them less partisan, and to try to make being a representative in Congress more like being a mayor or a school board member or a city councilor, and to really make it clear that my focus is always first and foremost on answering to my constituents. And so at the end of the day, that just struck me as the right move.
My last question to you, Representative Kiley, and I appreciate your time, sir. I started off my show opening monologue pretty much going off about how Trump is messing up because I'm of the mindset that he's messing things up for the GOP because they're not him. And the kind of things that he was able to get away with people capitulating too much to him and not holding him to account for some of the decisions that he makes, which may not be in the best interest of the American public, it could end up serving them, not serving them very well, particularly with the midterms coming up. I'm talking about the GOP, because we see the unpopularity kicking in. We see some of the question marks. We see affordability becoming an issue. You brought up the gas prices, et cetera, et cetera. And those were not things that he campaigned on. And plus, he talked about America First. Now you got the MAGA right, some of whom are against him because they feel like he hasn't been consistent with what he campaigned on. How worried, if at all, are you about the state of the GOP as the midterm approaches in light of some of the decisions that Donald Trump individually has made?
Well, I think that this is going to be an election that's decided based upon the cost of living. And so I think there actually have been some actions that have been really helpful in that respect. Expanding domestic energy production has been one of them. Obviously, we've seen this period of volatility in connection with Iran, but we had seen gas prices go down significantly. We have passed some, there's some pretty significant housing legislation being discussed in the House right now. And so you have seen some improvements, certainly with real wages going up. That's extremely important when it comes to the cost of living. That's your purchasing power right there. But again, I'm someone who's an independent. I think I'm running my own race. I'm not looking necessarily, looking at this through the lens of one party or the other. I'm looking at it through the lens of, okay, I'm going to show how I've been able to deliver for my constituents. And I will add that, a big part of the case that I'm going to make is that, yes, I'm demanding accountability in Washington, D.C. from both parties. But I'm also demanding accountability from Sacramento in my state, which is responsible for the biggest, slice of the overall cost of living that our citizens have to deal with. Not only do we have the highest prices, we have the highest housing prices in the continental U.S. We have the highest electricity rates, close to the highest water bills, the highest taxes, and that's why we have the highest poverty in California as well. When you factor in the cost of living, not to mention the highest homelessness, and the highest unemployment, highest illiteracy, the list goes on. So I think that that's going to be a big part of the case that I make to my constituents is, look, it's not about party for me. I'm going to hold folks in Sacramento accountable. I'm going to hold folks in Washington, D.C. accountable, and I'm going to work with people on all sides in order to lower the cost of living because it's just gotten out of control in California.
If you were running against Governor Gavin Newsom, he'd probably lean on the notion that, you know what, you said everything that you just said. Okay, how about the SAVE Act? Where do you stand on that to make his case against you? How would you answer that question? Where do you stand on the SAVE Act, sir?
Yeah, I'm for it. I mean, I think voter ID is common sense. I think the vast majority of people are for it. I've heard some of the critiques of the SAVE Act that maybe there aren't enough forms of ID or what have you that can be made available. If there are amendments that would improve in that respect, I'd totally be open to that. But I think the fact that we don't have voter ID in places like California is extremely unusual in democracies across the globe. There's maybe like two or three democracies in the world that don't have it. This is just kind of like a standard administrative requirement in a well-functioning democracy. So I think we should just have it. We should get this
Hold
over. We
on.
should move on with our lives. It shouldn't be a big controversial issue.
Excuse me for being so ignorant, asking last question. This is definitely my last question. What do you mean you don't have voter ID in California? Could you please elaborate specifically on that for my audience that may not know?
Yeah, California does not have voter ID. You don't need to present it to register. You don't need to present it to vote. As a matter of fact, the state passed a law forbidding voter ID. So cities, counties, if they
forbidding?
Want voter ID, they're not allowed to under state law.
What? When did that happen?
A couple years ago, because I think it was Orange County. They wanted to have their own requirements. So the state passed a law saying, nope, you're not allowed to. Voter ID is not only not required, it is actively forbidden.
Well, that's right. That's it right there. That's why the same act been proposed. Right there, the state of California. That's what the Republicans going to lean on as an excuse to definitely push forth the same act. Right there. Right there. I can't believe it. I didn't even know that, sir. I'm embarrassed to admit.
There's a lot of crazy things going on in California, but I think, you are seeing a return to sanity in some ways. And I see it, Democrats, Republicans, and independents in California who are saying, we need to do some things differently in this state.
By the way, last thing, no voter eligibility required. That's Gavin Newsom. Last 2 years, that was Gavin Newsom?
Correct. Well, so the law saying that a locality cannot have its own voter ID requirement, that was Newsom.
There you go. That was Newsom. That's all I needed to know. Thank you, sir. Representative Kevin Kiley right here with Stephen A. Really appreciate your time. Thank you so much. Good luck moving forward. Know that you're always welcome to come back here anytime, sir. Anytime.
Thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. One and only Representative Kiley right here with Stephen A. Straight Shooter with Stephen A. SiriusXM Portis Radio, Channel 124. I can't believe that last part. I thought every state, I mean, it's far be it from me. I thought every state just showed an ID. But little did I know. Lord have mercy. You can't make this up. Hour number, Trey Shooter with Stephen A. continues. Your calls over the next half hour to close out the show. A couple of lines open. A lot of people on the line. We'll get to your calls in just a minute. Don't go away.